Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the April issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. The World of 1883. Stars Sam Elliott, LaMonica Garrett, and Moore reveal the challenges and the once-in-a-lifetime thrills of shooting Yellowstone's epic prequel series. By Joe Layden. First, there was the good news. Multi-hyphenate Taylor Sheridan wrote the first script for 1883, a proposed prequel to his phenomenally popular Paramount Network drama Yellowstone, then submitted it to the brass at Viacom CBS, and almost immediately got the green light to start producing a series for the streaming service Paramount Plus. Naturally, Sheridan was greatly pleased and promised to start filming in early 2022, after he completed work on 2021 episodes of Yellowstone and another Paramount Plus project, The Mayor of Kingstown. That's when he got the bad news. It was April 2021, and Viacom CBS wanted 1883 ready to start airing by the following December. Talk about crunch time. As the December gala premiere of the first two 1883 episodes at Wynn Las Vegas, Sheridan recalled the sometimes spirited back and forth he had with Viacom CBS executive Keyes Hull Edgar after being given the series order. And unlike many of the foul-mouthed characters on his series, who routinely launch full assades of F-bombs at each other, he discreetly substituted a less objectionable word for a more familiar one when reporting the X's throwdown. Look, we are betting the house on this, and we are trucked if you don't do it. We're paying you a lot of trucking money, so you're trucking figure it out. According to Mike Fleming Jr. of the showbiz website Deadline, Sheridan told the Las Vegas audience, it was impossible to have something air in 7 months that wasn't cast, with no locations, and no other scripts. I said, this first episode I've written is the best thing I've ever written. If I can't have the time to make it right, I need everything else. I need the toys. I need the cast. I need the team. You will need to trust me, and it's going to hurt. And I did not hear the word no at all. Keep in mind, this meant Viacom CBS was signing an extraordinarily huge blank check for an epic-sized 10-episode series based almost entirely on their faith in Sheridan. 1883 would be, as its title indicated, a period drama about the ancestors of Yellowstone, paterfamilias John Dutton, Kevin Costner, as they traveled westward from Texas to the promised land of Montana with a wagon train of immigrant pioneers. Telling such a story would require exceptionally lavish production values to be at all credible to a contemporary audience that simply wouldn't accept the pinch-penny, small-screen aesthetic of, say, the classic TV series Wagon Train. And rest assured, Sheridan intended to dramatize that arduous journey with an accent on unflinchingly harsh realism and an emphasis on the capricious dangers faced by the travelers. Even if an actor were featured prominently in the opening credits of early episodes, that would not guarantee their character would survive to the season finale. As Chad Galster, Sheridan's longtime editor and collaborator, told CNI in a January interview, all of us collectively were saying at first, how are we going to do that? And I still don't know how we did it, but we did it, and it's airing. I mean, we are still working on it, But somehow, we got it done. And I don't know if it was the time pressure or the result in energy, but for myself, I think it's the best thing that I've ever worked on. And I believe Taylor has said the same thing, and we're all incredibly proud of it. And it is a minor miracle that it's on the air for people to enjoy. Almost immediately after getting the initial yes, Sheridan scrambled to assemble his lead players. C&I reader favorite Sam Elliott as Shea Brennan, the Pinkerton agent with a tragic past who signs on to lead the Pioneers on their cross-country trek. Husband and wife country music stars Tim McGraw and Faith Hill as James and Margaret Dutton, John Dutton's great-grandparents. LaMonica Garrett, Sons of Anarchy, designated survivor, as Thomas, a former slave and Buffalo soldier who is Brennan's friend and partner, and Isabel May as Elsa Dutton, James and Margaret's 18-year-old daughter. It falls to Elsa to underscore in her role as voiceover storyteller the mortal stakes of the journey through a vast and unforgiving wilderness. Here, there can be no mistakes, because here doesn't care. The river doesn't care if you can swim. The snake doesn't care how much you love your children. And the wolf has no interest in your dreams. If you fail to beat the current, you will drown. If you get too close, you will be bitten. And if you are too weak, you will be eaten. We are in the land of no mercy. Now, in the very first episode, however, 1883 emphasizes that long before the start of the journey, Elliot's Shea Brennan fully understood the randomness of death and devastation of loss. During a powerfully affecting flashback, Brennan silently yet tearfully grieves over the bodies of his wife and daughter, victims of smallpox, then sets fire to the home they shared in happier times. Given this, along with the battlefield horrors he witnessed as a Union officer during the Civil War, it's little wonder that Brennan is cruelly haunted by nightmares that make him want to avoid sleep, forcing Thomas to maintain a watchful eye on his apparently death-wishing friend. When asked about the difficulty of conveying anguish in that flashback, without dialogue, Elliot was typically modest yet blunt-spoken. "We were a couple of weeks into production when we did that," he told CNI. "Maybe 3 weeks. But it probably wouldn't have been any different if it was on the first day. It wasn't easy, but it wasn't that hard either. I'm an actor. I've got a wife and daughter at home. It's just a matter of getting into the scene and trying to bring some truth to it. I'm one of those who goes off and gets away from the noise before they get ready for me. I come back in and do it. It was that way that day, and everybody was supportive of it. Everybody was walking around and not making a lot of racket, so it allowed me to stay in that space." Focusing on Shea Brennan, Elliot credits Taylor Sheridan for giving him such a fascinatingly complex character to play. "There's so many things about this guy that are incongruent," Elliot said. "They don't make sense somehow. The fact that he's that vulnerable character who kind of bears his soul up there in this opening that we're talking about, and at the same time is willing to shoot some guy in the head because he stole somebody's bacon. Again, it's on the page. It's on the page, and that's my job. It's all a gift. It's a rich gift that has been given to me by a man that I have a lot of respect for as a writer. I think everybody on the show would tell you that. Everybody." LaMonica Garrett concurs, noting the episode when Thomas convinces a recalcitrant immigrant to return supplies he has pilfered. "When I speak and you don't do what I say, you get hurt. That's the pattern here. I don't stop until you do what I say, or you run out of face." "Yeah, Garrett told CNI with a hearty chuckle. Back in August, when I got the script, there were a handful of lines that jumped out at me like that. See, whenever I see something like this in any script by Taylor, I think, that's a Taylor Sheridan line. Because Taylor's a bad dude. But when I read that line, I closed the script and was like, man, this is going to be so much fun. Garrett's excitement was only slightly diminished while enduring the rigors of a pre-production cowboy camp Sheridan established to prepare cast members like himself with little or no experience on horseback. At first, Garrett said, it was extremely fun. It was life-changing. It does something to you to be on a horse that much. But after about 3-4 days, it turned from being fun, hey, cowboy camp, let's all go to cowboy camp, to it being work. It was 100 degrees. We're in Weatherford, Texas, and we're up the crack of dawn. We're tending to our horses. Yeah, it turned into work. That's when I got a real appreciation for cowboys, just the profession, the culture. It's some tough work. You watch all these shows growing up. You see cowboys, they're riding on the horses. It looks cool. I don't know, just a bunch of hero moments. But the real work of cowboying is no joke. I got a whole new respect for it now. And even more respect, Garrett added, for the pioneers depicted in 1883. Everything out there, everything in nature, especially in the 1800s, it seems like it's trying to kill you. You're just trying to get from point A to point B, and everything from weather to creatures, snakes, animals, wolves, bandits, everything is trying to kill you. A lot of people were grossly unprepared for everything that was coming at them. So I wouldn't have made it back then. I know now there was a different breed of human being back then. There's a couple of guys on the show that I think would have made it. I'm not one of them. Right from the start, a standout element of 1883 has been the laconic chemistry generated by Garrett and Elliot as two taciturn friends who can communicate with a minimum of verbiage, but understand that, given their vastly different backgrounds, there are some things in each man's past that the other will never fully appreciate. Garrett praises Elliot for going out of his way to cement this bonding on screen and off. We met each other in the saloon that's on Taylor's ranch, Garrett said. That's our little bubble where we could all come together and hang out and blow off some steam. The first time I met Sam, he gave me a hug. He embraced me and he was like, this is going to be amazing for both of us. Just knowing who Thomas and Shay are from day one, we just hit it off. One of the first scenes we did for the series was the first day of shooting for everyone. It was the scene where we're explaining to the immigrants that this is a snake, this is poison ivy, and so on. Taylor's sitting behind the camera, and we're rehearsing the lines about toilets, the back and forth between me and Sam. It just kind of kept going. It didn't stop. Taylor was laughing. Everyone around us was laughing. And Taylor was like, all right, you guys got it. And from that point on, he just let us do what we do. We've just grown closer and closer together, me and Sam. Elliot is equally enthusiastic about his partnership with Garrett and also speaks highly of co-stars Tim McGraw and Faith Hill. Again, like LaMonica, I think all of us really, in the beginning, hit it off, Elliot said. Yeah, there's probably a certain group of people that thought, oh yeah, here's these country singers, and now they're going to become actors, and they're going to try to pull that off. Well, they have pulled it off. They're incredible in this thing. I think the work that Faith and Tim are doing, it's as good as anything anybody else is doing in the show. They're up to it. At the time the folks quoted here spoke with CNI, cast and crew were still at work, on completing the initial 10 episodes of 1883 for Paramount Plus. I think the most difficult thing on this whole journey is the weather we've been dealing with, the elements. We started out down in Fort Worth and Weatherford. It was like 107, 108 degrees. We're out in the sun all day long wearing wool clothes. It was like being in a sauna most of the time. Then we went up to Montana. It was in the teens up there. We're surrounded by those snow-capped Rocky Mountains and winds howling. We came back down and we're back in Texas now. We got hit by a dust storm last Friday and it shut us down. We had to wrap early. The elements have been one of the biggest challenges for everyone. It's the journey within the journey almost. We're telling this story about this journey on the Oregon Trail, and within that, there's this other journey that we're on in the making of the show. You know, it's a challenge. But Elliot wasn't complaining. "It's fun, day after day," Elliot said. "It's all fun. I'm a believer that if you can't have fun making movies, then you're doing it the wrong way. You haven't got a clue. We're so fortunate to be doing what we're doing. We're in the entertainment business. Entertaining people is a wonderful thing. People need entertainment in this world we're living in. And I'm forever grateful and thankful to be able to say that I'm in the entertainment business." Stream 1883 online or on TV with Paramount Plus. Sign up or log in at ParamountPlus.com. Follow the fire. Barbecue Hall of Famer Stephen Raiklin has lots of meaty cookbooks and a smoke-filled empire to his credit. His latest book, Lights a Fire Under Veggies, by Elise Pierce. Stephen Raiklin could probably write a book on how to be super successful. If he did, he might call it Follow the Fire. That's what he's done for the past 2.5 decades, and it has served him well. Since the former French Lit major veered off course and landed in the world of crackling fires and sizzling meat, he never looked back. Instead, he kept looking inward, peeling back the stories, the recipes, and histories associated with the world's oldest form of cooking and selling more books than anyone thought possible. He struck gold with The Barbecue Bible, a tome of 500-plus recipes from around the world, and has penned more than 30 others. Along the way, he picked up 5 James Beard Awards and 3 IACP Julia Child Awards. He's even been inducted into the Barbecue Hall of Fame. All these smoke-filled years later, his enthusiasm for cooking with fire burns as bright as ever. You might have seen him on TV. His latest television show is called Project Fire, which airs on PBS. He has grill-themed shows in Canada and Italy, and you can catch him speaking French or Italian. In addition to all that, Raiklin's just had to make room on the bookshelf for one more cookbook. His newest, How to Grill Vegetables, the New Bible for Barbecuing Vegetables Over Live Fire, was released this May, and he's collaborating with Windstar Cruises on Star Grill by Stephen Raiklin, a barbecue and grill restaurant that will be in 3 of their ships. The first one is scheduled to open this year. We caught up with him between grilling and smoking at his home in Coconut Grove, Florida, to talk all things barbecue and how he got here in the first place. C&I, did you ever think that you'd be here 25 years later, still barbecuing, grilling, still smoking away? Raiklin, never in a million years. I wrote The Barbecue Bible in 1998, and right after it came out, it was a super big success immediately. Then I wrote a proposal for the Noodle Bible, and it just didn't seem to grab me the same way. Instead, one night, that may or may not have been substance enhanced, I wrote down all of the things that I wanted to do with barbecue. TV shows, barbecue you, and products. And that's been keeping me busy ever since. I sort of stumbled into a plan. CNI, what are some of the changes you've seen since you wrote the Barbecue Bible? How has grilling changed? Raycom, it's huge. When I first started, people didn't know what indirect grilling was. Grilling was something you did once a month or on the weekends. Our notion of international flavors was limited to teriyaki, and people maybe had heard of satay. Now, global flavors dominate our grilling, whether it's in restaurants or in our backyards. It's how we grill. Now we've become experts of direct and indirect grilling, and many people own smokers. That's what I'm doing with the Project Smoke TV show and with the Project Smoke book. It's pretty amazing. CNI, what do you think the fascination is with burned meat? Raycom, I like to say charred meat rather than burned meat. Many reasons. For one thing, it has always been with us. There has always been that fascination. We've come full circle from that historic moment when Homo erectus discovered we could cook meat with fire. I call it the first act of barbecue. That went to a chain reaction of barbecue, which included quadrupling or doubling the size of our brain and changing the size of our teeth, making us more communal and necessitating a division of labor. If you think about all of the things that make us human, intelligence, our communication skills, communal life, and social organization, all of that arose out of barbecue. So I think there's been a fascination of food cooked over fire that's imprinted in our DNA. It was always there, but when I was growing up, it didn't have the central role that it does now. CNI, why is grilling suddenly so popular right now, and everywhere, it seems? Raycom, most foods taste best cooked over live fire. Not just steak, but even vegetables. Vegetables, you steam them, you roast them in the oven. Okay. Under the broiler? Okay. But you cook over live fire. It just really intensifies flavor. It makes more foods taste more flavorful. We've also become obsessed with big flavors. Plus, there's a theatrical component to it. It's instant theater and instant party. You know, I like to think that I've helped advance the case for barbecue here in the U.S. and globally. My books have been translated into 17 languages, and they're all bestsellers. It's an idea whose time has come. Can anyone light a fire and throw something on the grill? Absolutely. You can fashion a grill out of a can of cooking oil and tin snips and fuel it with coconut shell charcoal, which is what the street vendors, the grill masters in the Southeast Asia do, and is incredibly cheap and effective. Contrast that with a Kalamazoo gaucho grill, which has a gas ignition system to burn logs and costs more than my first car. It's a sport that appeals to all levels. It's extremely democratic. No matter what your income, you can enjoy it and be good at it. It really does cross all boundaries. That's something I really love about it. Are there any commonalities among barbecue cultures around the world? Well, there's a common language that transcends words. If you were to take an Indian kebab, Walla, and put him next to Thai satay master, next to an Argentinian asador, and a Brazilian churrasco expert, even if they didn't speak the same language, they'd communicate. I've seen it time and time again. It's the same technical process. The secret to barbecue and grilling boils down to heat control and oxygenation and distance. You put food closer to the fire and it cooks faster and hotter. Away from the fire, it cooks cooler. Well away from the fire, if it's something that that's big and ornery, like barbecue brisket and ribs. The seasonings are what's different. The best Texas brisket is cooked with just salt and pepper. In Kansas City, you have elaborate spice rubs and mops. The third principle is the layering of flavors. In Indonesia, you might do a brine or a lime marinade with coconut and lemongrass flavors. We do the same thing with KC barbecue, which might start with a rub, then a spritz of apple cider during cooking, and finally a basting of barbecue sauce, not to mention the judicious application of wood smoke. Well, what about smoke? What role does it play in the live fire cooking globally? Smoke is a huge part of it in some parts of the world and not in other parts of the world. In Japan, they take enormous pride in their briquettes called binchotan. It's so pure and artisanal in fabrication. The last time I bought it, it was $2 a briquette. It burns super hot and is 100% pure. They're proud of the fact that no smoke flavor comes out of it. That then twitched to Texas, where smoke is the essence. Whether it's a steakhouse or barbecue joint, it's all about the smoke. Your new book, How to Grill Vegetables, is a departure from the previous ones. How did the idea for this one come about? It's both personal and intellectual. My daughter's a vegetarian. My wife prefers to eat vegetarian, and many other members of my family are vegetarian. What I love about barbecue is the field is so vast and so broad and deep. Project Smoke is about smoking. BBQ USA is about barbecue in the U.S. And the Brisket Chronicles was a deep dive into pastrami and cured meats. Coming off such meat-centric books, I thought vegetables. They're part of all my books, but I've never devoted a complete book to them, so I thought the time was right for that. You can smoke vegetables. Any tips? Smoking is great. I love smoked foods, and I love smoked vegetables. I love smoked gazpacho. You can smoke a tomato the conventional way if you cut it in half. You can smoke moist vegetables, like tomatoes, just like you normally would smoke something on your grill. But for a denser vegetable, you want to parboil it beforehand. Otherwise, it'll end up tasting like an ashtray. What's the biggest mistake people make when grilling? The biggest mistake is thinking all vegetables grill the same. But they don't. Vegetables divide rather neatly into high water content vegetables like zucchini, corn, peppers, mushrooms, and onions that demand a high heat and relatively short cooking time. And then a family of vegetables that are denser, drier, and firmer, like potatoes, winter squash, beets, parsnips, rutabaga, and turnips, that require a lower and more indirect heat. Biggest misconceptions about grilling. That it's a guy's thing. That's one. That it's one size fits all. That you grill everything the same way. You have to learn to control the fire and not let it control you. You see many people who build a raging fire and just throw food on it and think that by some magical process it will cook without burning. Is there anything you wouldn't grill? I would have said ice cream, but in fact I have figured out how to grill ice cream. And I include it in the new book, a recipe for smoked ice cream that's pretty amazing. I would have said sushi, but there's tataki that's raw on the inside and seared on the outside. I'm not sure I've found a food that you cannot grill.
Hello, this is Michael, reading from True West Magazine, February-March 2022 edition. Tamer of Raton Pass by Melody Groves. Uncle Dick Wooten helped build a nation with his Santa Fe Trail toll road. Well past midnight, everyone in the wagon train was snoring. First night on guard duty, teenager Dick Wooten spotted a stealthily approaching shadow in the chest-high grass. Convinced Indians were about to attack, He propped the large bore rifle against his shoulder, sighted down the barrel, and pulled the trigger. The shadow dropped. Heart pounding, he knew tonight would be memorable since he single-handedly had saved the entire bent St. Vran wagon train from certain death. Except it wasn't a sneaking Indian. The lead mule, Jake, had wandered off and was simply returning to camp. Wooten never did live that down. In 1836, he began a lifetime as a frontiersman, adventurer, trapper, guide, and businessman. Always seeking adventure, Uncle Dick Wooten is best known as the tamer of Raton Pass. Wooten fought and traded with Indians, trapped and scouted the western half of the country. He led wagon trains, herded buffalo, cattle, and sheep, farmed and ranched, and ran a stage stop in Trinidad, Colorado. He also constructed and operated a toll road across the mountains from Trinidad to Willow Springs, now Raton, New Mexico. Born Richens Lacey Wooten on March 6, 1816 in Virginia, he was 7 when his family moved to Kentucky. At age 17, Richens moved in with an uncle on a Mississippi cotton plantation. But he needed more excitement. Within 2 years, he moved to Independence, Missouri, and signed on as a wagon man. For years, he hauled freight for the firm of William and Charles Bent and Saren St. Vrain, crossing the Great Plains via the Santa Fe Trail. On that first trip, men mistook his name as Richard, so he became Dick. He acquired Uncle years later in Denver when he tapped 2 barrels of his Taos Lightning for appreciative miners. Raton Pass. Through the years, he successfully achieved many firsts, including opening a hotel, restaurant, and dry goods at a Colorado gold camp in what is now Denver. But he had harbored a desire grander than that. His many trips from Pueblo, Colorado, south into Fort Union and Santa Fe, New Mexico, had proven that a better, faster, safer road was vital to traffic on the Santa Fe Trail. This route was a commerce highway opened by merchant William Becknell, who correctly foresaw profits being made in transporting American goods across prairies to appreciative customers in Mexico's frontier. He used heavy Murphy freight wagons, and within a short time, the Santa Fe trade ballooned into $1 million a year business. The first official Santa Fe trail route was surveyed in 1825 by U.S. military patrols. So by the time Wooten took that initial freight wagon train across in 1836, the trail was well used. Travel had blossomed once Spain, which would not trade with the U.S., lost ownership of Mexico in 1821. Trade increased further in 1848 when the Southwest came under American rule after the Mexican War. Travel and trade from Franklin, Missouri to Santa Fe exploded. In May 1849, the first stagecoach line began monthly service between Independence, Missouri and Santa Fe. Building the pass wouldn't be easy. The 7,834-foot Raton Pass, named for imposing Raton Peak, was considered an obstacle to avoid at almost any cost. Most Santa Fe Trail traders chose the shorter, more level, and faster Cimarron route, despite the threat of Indian and Texian attacks. However, the severe lack of water on that route turned many travelers to the pass. Since 1821, when Becknell hauled the first wagon destined for Santa Fe over the pass, the difficulty remained legendary. Susan McGoffin, traveling with her army husband and one of the first women to traverse the pass, wrote in 1846, "Worse and worse the road. They are taking the mules from the carriage this p.m., and half a dozen men, by bodily exertions, are lowering them down to the Clifting Hills, and it takes a dozen men to steady a wagon with all of its wheels locked. We came to camp about a half hour after dusk, having accomplished the great travel of 600 or 800 yards during the day. Getting through the mountains was critical. During the Civil War, Raton Pass proved to be an important link between the Southwest and the Union, especially from 1861 to 62. Fear of the Confederate raiders from Texas and increased Indian hostilities had forced a virtual abandonment of the exposed Cimarron Cutoff. It was through the pass, shielded by the Rocky Mountains, that freighters continued to supply food and munitions to the isolated Union troops in New Mexico. Taming the trail, which began as an Indian route, was no small feat. Wooten wrote in his memoir, "The hills are broken, rock-bound, and ragged. Some are brown and bare. Others are covered with a thick growth of shrub oak, pinyon, and mesquite. While there are still others crowned with groves of always verdant pine, narrow wooded valleys are sprinkled throughout. It was almost impossible for anything but saddle horses and pack animals to travel the route at any time, and impassable for wagon trains or stagecoaches in winter." Following his dream of building a useful road in 1865, Wooten received charters from both New Mexico and Colorado territories to build one. In spring 1866, he moved his family to Raton Pass and chose a site for his house, the bottom of the steepest part of the Colorado side. Wooten hired engineers and surveyors. As most local men thought the work too hard, he employed a tribe of Utes under Chief Conneach. The Indians, using hard physical labor, improved 27 miles of the toughest part of the road. "I had undertaken no light task, I can assure you," Wooten wrote. "There were hillsides to cut down, rocks to blast and remove, bridges to build by the score. I built the road, however, and made it a good one, too." Taking a toll. Needing some way to pay for the construction, and of course to make a profit, Wooten established it as a toll road. He charged $1.50 for one wagon, 25 cents per horseman, 5 cents per head of livestock. There were two exemptions to the toll. Indians passed through for free because Wooten knew they wouldn't understand why they should pay to pass through their own area. And after all, the Utes had helped build the road. Lawmen chasing fugitives were also exempt. A time or two, Wooten even helped authorities by reporting who had passed through. Travel on Wooten's toll road increased in November 1867 when gold was discovered in New Mexico's Moreno Valley, and a daily Barlow and Sanderson stage route was established. Although Wooten kept no accounts of the receipts from his road, his partner, George C. McBride, did. Between April 1, 1869 and April 1, 1870, McBride recorded receiving $9,196.64, $185,952 in today's dollars. As stagecoaches began to rumble through the pass, Wooten quickly converted the house into a hotel, restaurant, and bar. "You couldn't run a stage station without a bar," he wrote, "so I had one." Many evenings were spent around the fireplace, with Wooten telling stories of his wilder days and stage passengers relating their latest scary traveling tales. The hotel became so popular, people from Trinidad and El Morro held dancers there every week. One of the ranches next to Wooten's belonged to Scottish immigrants, the Smith brothers, William, Hugh, and John, who went by the monikers Poke, Hoke, and Joke. Wooten, the Smiths, and neighboring ranchers rounded up their herds into Tin Pan Canyon, then sorted them out to brand them. One of Polk's sons often acted as designated driver for Wooten when he wanted to go into Trinidad and have a gay old time. The Smith teenager would wait outside the saloon with a buggy and then haul an inebriated Uncle Dick home safely. And then the railroad came. In 1878, progress came knocking at his door. The Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad offered to buy Wooten's toll road right-of-way through Raton Pass. Uncle Dick realized he was no longer the spry man he had been. The railroad took the place of the stage line, he reminisced, and since that time, I have lived in a different atmosphere from that in which I formerly lived. I almost feel I am no longer on the frontier and that there is no frontier to go to. Reluctantly, he agreed to sell his toll road and move to Trinidad. Initially, the railroad offered him $50,000, $1.3 million in today's dollars. But he turned down the deal, asking instead for only $1, unrestricted train travel for his wife and him, and grocery money for his wife's lifetime. They agreed on $25 per month for Maria Pauline Lujan Wooten, 40 years his junior. After Uncle Dick's death in 1893, at age 77, Maria continued receiving the agreed-upon benefits. In 1925, the Santa Fe Railroad doubled the payments, and in 1930, increased them to $75. After Mrs. Wooten's death in 1935, an invalid daughter received $25 a month during her lifetime. It wasn't until 1980 that the two-story ranch house at the base of the pass was torn down. Over his lifetime, Dick Wooten married at least four times and sired 20 children. He outlived all but one wife and three children. He is buried in Trinidad, Colorado. Navigating the Pass. Today, the Burlington Northern and Santa Fe Railroad rolls over Wooten's Pass. Interstate 25 often parallels the train route. An early Raton Pass road, built for autos and parts of the original SFT, can be traveled by heading up Moulton Avenue in Raton. The street makes a sharp left, then bends right, and starts up a switchback road to the top of the mesa. The road is barricaded about halfway with no access to the private property on the other side. The pavement is in poor repair, and because there are no guardrails, the drive should not be attempted lightly. Photos of Model Ts with gravity gas tanks backing up the pass are on display at the Raton Museum. New Mexico native Melody Groves loves the area where she grew up. Exploring ghost towns and riding horses sparked her Wild West imagination. Winner of numerous writing awards, she writes Western fiction and nonfiction. True West Magazine, February-March 2022 edition. The Lone Star Myth of John Ringo by Mark Boardman. His time in Texas was not what it's cracked up to be. In August 19, 1875, a rider, or maybe riders, approached the Bader Ranch in Mason County, Texas. He went out to the fields where Carl Charlie Bader was working the land. Exactly what happened is not known, but it's believed the rider took little time to plug Charlie, who dropped dead on the spot. Most experts agree the rider was Scott Cooley, seeking revenge for the killing of a friend a few weeks earlier. But he made a mistake. His target was Charlie Bader's older brother, Peter, who would get his a bit later. Several modern reports suggest that Cooley was accompanied by John Ringo, who would go on to great fame in southeast Arizona. And there may have been others involved. But Ringo biographer David Johnson takes issue with that. In his book, John Ringo, Johnson digs into the contemporary stories of the killing. None mention Ringo, and none agree on who, if anyone, the additional riders might have been. Just as important, there is no evidence that Cooley and Ringo joined up until a month later. At that point, they were a dangerous duo. Okay, others rode with them. Indeed. But Johnson isn't certain that Scott and John even knew each other in August. Finally, while many chroniclers say that the Bader shooting was part of the infamous Mason County Hoodoo War, Johnson challenges that. His assertion is that Cooley was taking his pound of flesh to avenge a friend. The feud had nothing to do with it. Scott Cooley likely killed Charlie Bader all by himself. It fits with his solo revenge killing of Mason County Deputy John Worley 9 days earlier. Bader wasn't Ringo's first gun notch. But Ringo would rectify that on September 25th. He and a man identified only as Williams rode to the home of Jen Cheney, north of the town of Mason. By the time Ringo and Cooley had taken sides in the war, soldiering for the Americans in their fight with German immigrants, Cheney was an enemy who had led two of their friends into a fatal ambush. When Ringo and Williams rode up to his house, Cheney, on the front porch, invited the men to have breakfast with him. He then washed his face and hands in preparation for the meal. While he was drying off his face, Ringo and his confederate gunned down Cheney. Ringo was eventually arrested in the killing and spent much of 1876 and 1877 in jail. For at least a part of the time, gunman John Wesley Hardin was held under the same roof. By that time, people wanted to brush the more or less finished Mason County War under the rug and forget about it. And a courthouse fire had destroyed many of the original documents in the cases against Ringo. Charges against him were dismissed in 1878, and after a brief period, John moved on to Arizona Territory, where he would become the stuff of legend. That legend, of course, tells us of a man who was one of the deadliest pistolers in the West. It points to his time in Texas, where he dispatched many a man with his quick draw and unerring aim. It just didn't happen that way. Ringo didn't participate in one of the killings attributed to him. And the other, he shot an unarmed man who had a towel over his face. When the legend becomes fact, print the legend. John Ringo, especially in his time in Texas, epitomizes that saying. True West Magazine, February-March 2022 edition. Native History Celebrated Large by Jana Bommersbach. Only months old, the first Americans Museum in Oklahoma City is dedicated to truth-telling. It was once called Indian Territory, a dumping ground as tribe after tribe was forced off their eastern lands and settled in this western spot. When it found a name, two Choctaw words were used, meaning red people, Okla and Homa. In 1907, it became the 46th state, and in 2021, it proudly proclaimed its native history with the opening of the First Americans Museum in Oklahoma City. One place, many nations, it declares, as it presents the collective history of the 39 distinct Native nations in the state today. Outside of Alaska, Oklahoma has the highest relative population percentage of indigenous people based on state population. Here is where you'll hear authentic voices, says Jenny Underwood, a Comanche who is marketing director at the museum. You hear we and us, not they and them. The museum is a 30-year-old dream, first promoted by State Senator Kelly Haney, a former chief of the Seminole Nation in the late 1990s, who sponsored legislation to create a museum. Eventually, a site was chosen, Oil Field No. 1, which once supplied 60% of the oil for the U.S., but had dried up and now was a dump. The wells had to be capped and the land brought back. That took years, but in 2005, there was a ground blessing to heal the space, and in 2006, construction began on the museum. COVID certainly didn't help, but in September of 2021, the First Americans Museum opened in a striking building that is a giant cosmological clock. At the spring and fall equinox, the sun enters from the front entrance gate. Underwood is proud that 80% of the museum's staff and 100% of its curators are natives. The love and care we're giving to objects here is really fantastic. We can't go into depth on all the 39 nations, but we can focus on our shared experiences, she adds. Each nation has its distinct culture and language. It would be like telling the stories of all European nations in one museum. Among the exhibits are 140 objects on loan from the Smithsonian, which let each nation select three objects. One of the curators was able to link some of the objects back to their families of origin, still living in Oklahoma. There's also a restaurant that offers indigenous cuisine and a shop with a one-of-a-kind work by Indian artists. Underwood notes that only four tribes were indigenous to the area. Another four roamed through it regularly, but all the rest ended up here by Americans' Indian removal policy. At one point, many expected these tribes to become extinct, so their survival is celebrated by the museum. The museum sees its responsibility as to educate the broader public and foster truth-telling. It wants everyone to see the unique culture, diversity, history, contributions, and resilience of the First American Nations in Oklahoma today. Jana Bommersbach has earned recognition as Arizona's Journalist of the Year and won an Emmy and two Lifetime Achievement Awards. She co-wrote the Emmy-winning Outrageous Arizona and has written three true crime books, a children's book, and the historical novel Cattle Kate. True West Magazine. Saloons, Paniolos, and Telegraphs. February-March 2022 edition by Marshall Trimble. Was there racial separation in the Old West? Could a black cowboy go into a tombstone saloon? Jeffrey S. King, Washington, D.C. It's difficult, if not impossible, to provide a simple answer. The West is the largest region in the United States, and the period known as the Old West spanned just a few decades. But many parts of the West were settled by Southerners, so segregation prevailed in those areas. Being a cowboy was one of the few jobs open to men of color. Black and white cowboys mixed and mingled with each other. Working for an outfit meant riding for the brand. If cowboys working for the same outfit came into a saloon, it's likely they drank together. And if anybody didn't like it, there was a good chance a brawl occurred. Black and white, those who rode for the brand, stuck together in the ruckus. Several other accounts reported violence when blacks tried to get served in white bars and vice versa. Pity the poor Chinese. Most of the animosity and prejudice in the West was directed at them. This eased some of the discrimination against blacks. How did Indians communicate with whites? Bob Powers, Cincinnati, Ohio. They might use sign language, or they might use an interpreter, often based on a common non-Indian language. In the North Country, French was the common language. In Apache and Navajo country, they spoke Spanish, the universal language of the Southwest. In some cases, the whites had lived among the Indians and had learned their language. There was no one-size-fits-all when it came to communication. Can you tell me about Hawaiian cowboys? George Abril, Indio, California. In 1823, the King of Hawaii, King Kamehameha III, imported some vaqueros from Spanish California to teach the Hawaiians how to gather, ride, rope, and herd the wild cattle on the island. They were called Españoles, Spaniards, which the native Hawaiians pronounced Paniolos. In time, all cowboys in Hawaii became known as Paniolos. Two good sources on them are Rough Riders, Hawaii's Paniolo and Their Stories by Lilma Lewis, and Aloha Rodeo, Three Hawaiian Cowboys, The World's Greatest Rodeo, and A Hidden History of the American West by David Wolman. How did the telegraph system work in the Old West? Jim Zierke, Sussex, Wisconsin. Like a post office letter, in addition to your message, you specified who the message was from, who it was intended for, and where they were located. Your telegraph station would send it to the next nearest station, which forwarded it on until it got to the destination telegraph station. A messenger would get on his bicycle and deliver the telegram. If that was not possible, the destination station would hold it until the receiver picked it up. How did Bob Ford, the killer of Jesse James, die? Joe Marquez, Whittier, California. On June 8, 1892, Ed O'Kelly entered Ford's tent saloon in Creed, Colorado, carrying a shotgun. Witnesses said Ford's back was turned. "Hello, Bob," O'Kelly said. As Ford turned around, O'Kelly cut loose with both barrels. Ford died instantly. Thus, Ed O'Kelly became the man who killed the man who killed Jesse James. He never explained his reason for gunning down Bob Ford. After 7,000 people signed a petition in favor of his release, O'Kelly's sentence was commuted, and he was freed on October 3, 1902. He was shot and killed 2 years later when he attacked an Oklahoma City lawman.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.